our iBlink studying class. What did we get here? Just to remind you, we had 60 conditioning trials, 3 blocks of 20. And we had actually 7 blocks of 4 probe trials. Now, typically, when we tend to analyze data, we tend to collapse individual trials into blocks and then average within the block. It just makes it a little bit easier. It reduces individual trial-by-trial variation a bit. So we've got an acquisition period, and we actually have an extinction period. Now, technically, every single one of our test trial blocks is technically an extinction period, but then we go back into acquisition. So we did 20 conditioning trials. Then we did a probe trial, P1 here, of four trials. Conditioning 2, another 20 conditioning trials. Probe 2, so our second block of 4 probe trials. Conditioning 3, 20 more conditioning trials. And then all of the next, all of the rest of our probe trials here are all essentially extinction trials because we never go back to conditioning there. So looking here at this, at the results from the individual groups, or the results then of the individuals, we get this sort of pattern. So for one of them here, we get this. So our probe trials there, we've had 20 conditioning, then a probe trial, 20 conditioning, probe trial, 20 conditioning, and here's, you know, these blocks then 3 to 7 are all post conditioning. So these are all essentially our extinction here. Second group, third, fourth is just straight along the. It's like, where's the line? nothing at all. No responses whatsoever on any of them. Fourth, we get this. So, you know, when we look at this, it seems that the people are pretty much all over the place. Now, keep in mind, you say, well, what's going on? We've got 5 different groups, you know. There's going to be a lot of variation in terms of how we said that, how to do this. I didn't really give very detailed operational definitions or methodology. And, you know, from the groups I was observing, for some of them, they were very stoic and serious, and you know, others, there was a lot of laughter going on. There was wildly different CSs. Some were finger snaps. Others were very loud pounds on the desk. Others seemed to be some knuckle taps. So we've got a lot of variation, and that's fine. I mean, right, this is just a pedagogical exercise. One thing that may make this look a little different is if we sort of average the data here. So, you know, averaging this, you know, we do get our probe trials here doing acquisition. We've certainly got some acquisition, okay? We've definitely got some conditional responding here. And we start to see some extinction going on here as well. If we'd kept going with this, there probably would have been some more extinction, but kind of a trade-off in terms of class exercise, amount of time it's taking, and you know, pedagogical value here. So perhaps if we'd kept going with maybe another 5 or 6 blocks of probe trials there, we you know, have even more extinction drop down closer to zero there. Okay, so that's what we got there. Any questions with that? Okay, I'm gonna go back to our third chapter stuff. We stopped a little bit early there. Didn't get to the taste aversion. So let's go back and wrap up our bit about taste aversion, and then we'll go back to the new stuff in Chapter 4. So back to your Chapter 3 notes. Okay, so taste aversion, we've got a unconditional stimulus. That's our stimulus that produces some sort of illness. The UR is the attributes of the illness itself, the nausea, the sickness, whatever it happens to be. However that manifests. CS generally is going to be a novel flavor, taste, smell, some combination of things there. And our CR will be nausea induced by or a feeling of avoidance or disgust or something produced in response to the conditional stimulus. You can quibble about this. You can either talk about taste aversion as being a long delay form of learning or a trace conditioning process. So in long delay, the CS is presented sometime, a long time past, and finally the U.S. occurs. So you consume, let's just say, the novel food. You have some food for the first time, and then an hour or two later, so time has passed, you become ill. The botulism catches up with you, or whatever it happens to be. Now, you say, well, how's the, you're not eating the food for the full, like, 2 hours there. It's like, no, but, you know, some theorists have said, well, but maybe you've still got a lingering taste of it in your mouth or something like that. You haven't brushed your teeth or, you know, used mouthwash or something, so the flavor of it is still with you. Okay, so that could be a long delay situation. Most people tend to go with trace. You consume the novel food. You're done eating. Time passes, a few hours pass, and then let's just say the botulism kicks in, the food poisoning kicks in, and you get ill. So that can be more of a trace. You experience the CS. The eating component is over. Time passes, and then you experience the U.S. In either case, whether you want to quibble about it being a long delay conditioning or a trace conditioning, in both cases, neither of these is a great way, as we discussed before, of actually establishing a strong conditional response, right? Neither is as good as a short delay process here. Time is passing, other stimuli can interfere, there's the time estimation issue going on. Both of these, whether it's long delay or trace, are violating contiguity, or at least are reducing, maybe not violating completely, but reducing the contiguity. So in either case, taste aversions should be rather more difficult. And so part of, if you go back into the literature in the 1960s, taste aversion research became sort of a big thing. And it led to a lot of debate, theoretical debate. Some people argue, I mean, the fact that you can acquire taste aversion after a single conditioning trial was leading some theorists to say, this we should treat this as just a special form of learning all on its own. So we can have, like, habituation sensitization, we can have classical conditioning, operant conditioning, and taste aversion. Because, you know, you do it in one trial. Generally, in classical conditioning, it takes more than one trial to form a conditional response. But it's like, in this, you get it generally just after one pairing of the CS and the illness. So it's just the contiguity was a bit of a problem for a lot there. It's no longer a problem. Taste aversion is just seen as being a slightly special case of classical conditioning where the salience is just really high. Second issue that created, in some ways, some bigger problems for some of the early researchers in taste aversion, particularly Garcia and Kolling, was what was called the equipotentiality premise. Now, this goes back to Pavlov. Pavlov, and again, this is partially, it wasn't that Pavlov was wrong, it's just given the kinds of stimuli that he was using in his lab, I mean, he knew about taste aversions, but again, he was using very, like, lights and tones and whatnot. He wasn't using some really esoteric kind of stimuli at this point. Pavlov just said, look, it shouldn't matter what you use as conditional stimulus. He says, you know, any stimuli, assuming for equality of salience, should be conditionable to any U.S. He says something's going to be easily conditioned to a U.S. Anything else should be easily conditionable. If something's going to be difficult, it should all be difficult with this. So this is called the equipotentiality premise. We'll come back to this again a little bit later. But we'll see in this example of taste aversion how this caused some problems here. Some of the early work, really good early work that was like not just saying, hey, you can have taste aversion, but actually trying to delve into these questions about contiguity and equipotentiality were by Garcia and Kolling. And they came up with several studies, at least two in 66, Garcia and Kolling and a second one, Garcia Irving and Kolling. They had a lot of trouble getting their work published. They submitted their research to a number of journals. It was rejected. Their manuscripts were rejected numerous times. They finally got accepted into Psychonomic Science. Now, a little background information here. There are what we call different sort of tiers or levels of journals, like the first-tier journals, the very prestigious journals, like, you know, Nature or Science or things like that. Journal of Experimental Psychology is like, you get stuff published there, you know, it's like, woohoo, you're doing great, okay? And then there's like second-tier journals, animal behavior, ethology, stuff like that. It's like, yeah, you know, good job. And then there's like, you know, lower-tier third or fourth, you know, South African Journal of Paranormal Psychology, you know, that guy. It's a real journal, okay? There's actually some interesting stuff, and there's also a lot of just, you know, like, wonky stuff. Anyway, Psychonomic Science was not a top-tier journal back in the 60s. It's moved up a lot, in part because of they agreed to publish this work, and it turns out that Garcia and Colleen were bright, and people went, hey, I want to publish in that journal because they published the good stuff. So interesting little thing about reinforcement there. Anyway, so it finally got published in Psychonomic Science. Why was this so difficult? Well, look, here's what Garcia and Colleen were doing. They had, in terms of contiguity, they had things like the U.S. via poison, lithium chloride, different studies of different things, but let's just go with poison for right now. It's called poison. Lithium chloride or other things that will cause nausea. In some cases, they actually used an X-ray machine. They gave, like, the rats radiation poisoning. This is probably why psychologists should not be given access to radiation. It's like, I don't know, I got an X-ray machine. Let's just crank it up. You know, can we get her high enough to induce radiation poisoning? Well, yeah, it's not really recommended. I'll do it! You know, it's like, wow, I can see the rat's bones and I don't need the, I don't actually need the film. It's like, yeah, it's great. Leave the X-ray machine to the radiation technologists there. But anyway, so they use different things, but we'll just call it poison here. So the U.S., something that's going to produce nausea. And their CS was novel flavors, in some cases food, in other cases stuff added to liquids, to drinks. They had, in the Garcia, Irving, and Colling study, they had a delay between the CS and the U.S. of 5 to 22 minutes. Regardless of whether or not the delay between being presented with the CS and having the U.S. delivered was 5 to 22 minutes, these all produced very strong conditional responses in terms of avoidance of the CS in future, lack of consumption. Now, you want to find 22 minutes. That's, you know, 22 minutes isn't that long compared to other kinds of, you know, ring the bell, give some food. You know, a 22-minute delay there, conditioning was just going to suck. Technical term there, okay? Do terribly. And so this is like, whoa, this is weird. In some of their other, work, they showed they could still get a significant conditional response waiting 24 hours in rats between the delivery of the CS and the delivery of the US. Now, definitely weaker. You know, it's not like a really strong avoidance, but it's still there. Again, you do anything else with, like, sound of the tone and foot shock, it's like, beep. Let's come back 24 hours later and give you a shock. It's like, nothing. You're just not going to get learning about that. Going to get any sort of freezing conditional response there in your rat. So it's like, whoa, you know, you must have done something wrong, right? I mean, the reviewers are going, it's like, no, this doesn't make sense. You've got something wrong with your data. So they're sending the manuscripts in to be, you know, trying to get them published, and the reviewers are all going, no, contiguity, really important. You've violated 24 hours. There's something wrong there. You know, go back, redo the study. No, we sure are not going to publish this. So they had a lot of problems on that side. They also had problems with respect to, in another one of their studies here, the Garcia and Colling 66 study, violation of equipotentiality. So in this case here, they had two unconditional stimuli, X-ray, that's going to produce radiation poisoning and give the rats nausea. Rats can't vomit. If they could, they'd be bleh, they'd be throwing up all over, but they physiologically just can't throw up, so this has induced some intense nausea in the rats. And they had a second U.S. foot shock. They had two different conditional stimuli, what they called flavored water and bright, noisy water, audiovisual. So when the rats would drink from the water bottle, a light would blink on and off, blink, 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 and a clicking sound would go, you know, tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick-a. So they'd have flashing, so an AV stimulus, but bright, noisy water. preconditioning testing, so they check and see whether or not there's any difference. I mean, you know, if it turns out that the rats just will really have a preference for flavored water over the bright noisy, we're going to have to account for that. But it didn't matter. I mean, the rats would drink the flavored water and the bright noisy water equally. So that's the preconditioning phases here. Post-conditioning, so it's like preconditioning, you expose to the CSs, then again, wait various times here, present the US, either the X-ray or the shock. Let the subjects recover, bring them back later, expose them to the CS again, give them an opportunity to drink. And what we find here is when the US is the X-ray, induces nausea, we get a very significant reduction in the amount of flavored water consumed, but they drink the same amount of the bright, noisy water as they did before. It has no effect on the consumption, the CR of consumption of the bright, noisy. But in the case where the US is the shock, we get the opposite results. Here, we've got an aversion to the bright, noisy water, but has no effect on the consumption of the flavored water. And again, this is a violation of Pavlov's equipotentiality. Pavlov argued, you should have all, you know, if it is easy to condition a CS to a US, all CSs should be equally conditionable. So if our flavored water is easily conditioned, we get a strong conditional response here with the X-ray, doesn't matter. If our US is a shock, we should see a strong aversion to the flavored water again. But we don't. And again, this was a problem for Garcia and Kolling, because the kinds of people that were reviewing their journal article, I mean, some of them, it's like, I knew Pavlov personally, and Pavlov was like a god, said equipotentiality premise. And you, my friends, have violated equipotentiality. You are wrong. In terms of the right, but the scientists, the other psychologists, you know, biases, their expectation effects were interfering with us. Yeah. Sure. I mean, you could do well. Could you bring the reviewers into your lab when you have your journal article peer reviewed? You tend not to know who the reviewers are. It's as anonymous as possible. Generally, the reviewer doesn't know whose work they're reviewing, and the people that submit their papers don't know who's doing the reviewing.
But is it still biased?
Well, it depends, right? I mean, sure, there can still be biases, but. You know, as I said, eventually they got this published, and then other people went out and said, well, let's test that. And this is the scientific replication process. So something goes out, and other people say, no, that can't be right. I'm gonna prove Garcia and Kolling wrong. It's like, holy crap. I've got to stop saying this stuff on podcasts. Holy rat droppings, Batman. Garcia, I'm getting the same results as Garcia and Kolling. I'm going to do a follow-up publication saying, you know, we tried to disprove this, and it's like, we can't. And somebody else goes, wait a minute, and tries, and it's like, what do you know? And so after a few more publications came out trying to replicate Garcia and Kolling, a lot of them, because like, no, that's got to be wrong. It's like, what do you know? Methodologically, there's nothing wrong here. They're actually correct. You know, whereas in other cases, somebody comes out with something and it's like, well, I don't know about that. It's like, I don't know, you're wrong. You know, we can't replicate this at all. It's like, oh, okay, that seems to be an erroneous report there for whatever reason. Okay, so that's how science works. It goes back and forth. You know, they did get it published here. And what happened out of this was Garcia and Kolling's interpretation that biological predispositions were extremely important became recognized. In this case here, the case is, you know, nausea and flavor biologically predisposed. They go together. In case of something like shock, damage, pain in the extremities, and an audiovisual stimuli, again, if you just think sort of the biology of a rat or, you know, most mammals, again, these go together. It's like, whoa, yeah, I ate some sushi and, oh, my hand is bleeding. Damn you, sushi! It's like, what the heck? Like, what were you doing? Like, slamming rice on your hand or something? It's like, ah, yes, the raw fish. It doesn't go together. If your hand gets cut, You know, if you get an injury a few hours after eating sushi, you don't blame the sushi. It's like, hey, maybe it's because I've been juggling knives. That could have something to do with it. Yeah. Huh? Okay, so biological predispositions recognized to be very important there. We'll talk more about those later. So, as I said, you know, in terms of, this is very interesting, and you know, and in fact, partially because of this little story with Garcia and Collings having difficulty publishing, this has actually sort of become one of these case studies of a reminder to psychologists that just because an important name in the field, Pavlov or Thorndike or, you know, Watts or whoever says something, don't necessarily mean it's true. You know, step back and go, okay, you know what? If there doesn't seem to be any obvious methodological flaw in the article, the methodology is fine, they're still getting wonky results, okay, maybe that should be published. Somebody else can try to replicate it, and then we'll just see. We'll just see what happens. If it turns out that it can't be replicated, this will drop out of the, you know, it's like, oh, well, you know, we don't know what happened. It doesn't work anywhere else. Probably not accurate, or there's something else going on. So, very significant. A part of this comes into scientific paradigms. I mean, if evidence actually contradicts a fundamental premise, and it seems to be a very well-supported premise, generally you reject the evidence, or you're less likely because there's probably something wrong. Something, it's an oddity of the research subjects, or the drug used, or its unique effect, or whatever. But, you know, as I said, the Garcia and Colling experience here has been this reminder for psychologists, and this is why we keep teaching about it in textbooks as well, to kind of remind future generations of psychologists. It's like, just because you get something that's unexpected, it may be wrong. You know, maybe there's been a methodological flaw in the reasoning, a bias in terms of the subjects that were selected. Who knows? But don't just reject out of hand. Look at it carefully. Think about it. Sometimes that may be correct, and it may change an entire way of thinking. So we've had this paradigm shift in terms of things like equipotentiality, taste aversion, contiguity, and in particular, biological predispositions in classical conditioning and operant conditioning, for that matter. Okay, so that takes us up to, concludes the Chapter 3 stuff that we're going to get through. And we're now, sorry, going to skip to the Chapter 4 stuff. So, okay, this is the Chapter 4 stuff. Chapter 4 deals with some mechanisms in classical conditioning and theory. Okay, so we're going to be going through that here today. So, first off, we talk about unconditional and conditional stimuli. Typo on my part here. Should be a capital S. There we go. So much better. So your unconditional stimulus that elicits a response without training. That's sort of the definition we gave you before. A conditional stimulus elicits a response due to training. An association has to be made. Now, does this mean that if something is a US, it cannot be a CS or vice versa? No. It's actually not quite as simple as this. You can have things that can be both USs and CSs. So we're going to consider this a little bit. Think about aversive conditioning. We often will talk about, you know, with rats, you know, we set up a situation where you sound a tone and then bzz, give them a foot shock as the US. And then the rats either do avoidance responding or they freeze as the CR or whatever. But the tone becomes a CS that's predictive of the US. Pavlov, though, demonstrated that you could take a mild shock and turn it into a CS for food. So if you had a food-deprived dog, now we can switch this around. So our mild shock in the aversive conditioning, the shock's the US, but here we can take and turn this US into a CS for a different US. So these things aren't hard and fast conditional or unconditional stimuli. They're not necessarily just going to be one thing. The context, the training, in some cases even the species or individual are going to be very important here in making this kind of determination. Consider sign tracking. Sign tracking, right? The light's off to the side, and our U.S. might be a saccharin flavor. Okay, so rats like saccharin. They like sweets, no nutritional value to saccharin, so you can eat it all day and not get fat. Very useful, they don't satiate. The light becomes the CS. The rat goes over to the CS, directs food-related behaviors to the light because of the properties of the unconditional stimulus, the saccharin. However, in taste aversion, you know, an illness now is our U.S. If we poison the saccharin, the flavor of the saccharin now becomes a CS, and the poisoning, that's our U.S. So again, the can't, it's not fair to say they're just going to be one thing or another. You have to know about the context. You have to know exactly what's being trained up here. In similar ways, we can look at things like stimulus novelty. And this can affect learning, whether or not we're going to have stimulus actually being able to be turned into a conditional stimulus or not. So prior associations become significant. And this is one of these reasons why laboratory studies tend to control for this very carefully. You know pretty much the history. You know, if you raise, you know, get your rats when they're, you know, newborns or pups, you know all the prior sort of associations they've been exposed to. Much harder to do in the real world out there, the uncontrolled real world. So we can talk about familiar and unfamiliar stimuli. Familiar stimuli being ones that have been presented before. You probably acquired some sort of associations between these stimuli. Unfamiliar stimuli we might also call novel. Now, if you take and you've got a familiar stimuli and you try to train it up in a different way, what we're going to find here is it's harder to do. So if we've conditioned a tone with foot shock, and then we say, hey, let's take and actually condition this tone to mean the delivery of something appetitive, food, you can do it, but it's going to be harder. Right now, sometimes people talk about, it's like, well, you have to unlearn what you already learned. You have to unlearn that the tone means foot shock, and then you have to relearn that it means food. It's not quite the case. You're not exactly unlearning what you knew about the tone in the past. It's not like it's like, oh yeah, that's gone. You're really just learning something different. It's like, yeah, tone means foot shock. At least it did, but now it seems to mean food. Maybe in the future it might mean foot shock again. I mean, we talked about the, you know, spontaneous recovery, reoccurrence, resurgence, relearning process. It takes less time to relearn after extinguishing. So in these cases here, we're not forgetting, we're not completely overriding, we're not destroying that learning. So we're not unlearning it. Or unlearning sounds like you're, you know, kind of erasing it or something like that. You're learning something different, learning something new. Okay, it's a little bit of a quibbly point about sometimes how some textbooks or people talk or write, but, you know, it's an important issue in terms of the theory. It doesn't seem that our nervous system just obliterates the past stuff that we've acquired. It seems to stay there, but we acquire new connections, new associations. One of the ways we can look at this is in what's called latent inhibition, also called CS pre-exposure. They're essentially the same thing. If you take a highly familiar stimulus, okay, so you've trained the stimulus with a particular unconditional stimulus, done a lot of conditioning here, it is going to be more difficult to associate it with a unconditional stimulus, with a new unconditional stimulus. Pardon me, I'm sorry, I'm thinking of something slightly different. CS pre-exposure, right, I'm thinking of a different exposure effect. CS pre-exposure, we present a stimulus by itself, right, that's why I've got it in scare quotes here. It's not a CS yet, okay? We're just taking some stimulus and tone. Yeah, what happens? Nothing. Tone. Anything happening? No. Tone. Okay, there's a tone. Okay, we do that a bunch, all right? Then, that's called our pre-exposure group, okay? Our experimental group there, our pre-exposure group. Control group, if you will, just, you know, sits in the chamber for the same amount of time, but no tone is delivered, okay? Phase two, in both groups, our experimental and our control, we now try to do classical conditioning association. So CS paired up with the US, or our tone here, our stimulus, that we, in the pre-exposure group, the experimental group, we just presented a whole bunch of times. We now pair with the U.S. And in our control group, completely novel, it's like for the very first time, it's like, don't, and hey, there's the U.S. And then we do this for the same amount of trials. I don't know. I don't care how many, 20 trials, 40 trials, whatever, be consistent. And then phase three, we do the testing. If you do that, the magnitude of your conditional response that you're going to get for your control group, one that's just gone straight into your basic acquisition learning, is going to be much stronger than from your experimental group, the one that had the pre-exposure. Okay? So CS pre-exposure, you're either pre-exposed to the stimulus that will eventually become the conditional stimulus, or latent inhibition, there's some inhibition of learning caused from this just exposure to the stimulus by itself. Now, generally accounted for by habituation interpretation. Okay? And again, this gets back to what I was saying in terms of, you know, a U.S. is not necessarily always a U.S. It might be a CS, you know, a little bit of ambiguity here. Typically, we tend to think of habituation applying to unconditional stimuli, right? So habituation causes the reduction in a reflexive response. That's the basic way we deal with it. If you look at the nervous system, right, we've got a reflex, and habituation, simplest form of learning, causes a reduction in a reflexive response due to repeated presentation of the stimulus. Okay. But here, right, a little bit of ambiguity in this case here, we're talking about taking a stimulus, a novel stimulus, a tone or a light, whatever, that really, in and of itself, doesn't do much of anything. At least there's no really obvious reflex happening. You might say, well, if we sound a tone, beep, and maybe there's a little bit of an orientation response or a little bit of an attentional response, but okay, so I guess we can maybe say it's a fairly weak unconditional stimulus, but not in the same way that we're getting a really profound reflex occurring here. Right? Anyways, again, this should just get you thinking a little bit, what do we mean when we call things a CS or a US? What do we mean when we talk about habituation of a reflexive, you know, a neural arc pathway? And so as such, the way this is commonly explained is that latent inhibition occurs by reducing the attentional processes. So you habituate to this the stimulus, so tone. Is anything happening? Nope. Tone. Okay, I'm habituating to it. It's like I'm not even paying attention to it because nothing happens. Yeah, whatever. Tone. It's like you don't even know the tone's there. Finally, it's like tone and, ooh, unconditional stimulus. It's like, what the heck? So I just got this unconditional stimulus. Did you notice that the tone preceded it? The what? The tone, that thing that we just given you 40 or 50 presentations of? Was there a tone? I just remember the food. Hey, there it is again. There's the food. I just got food stuffed into my mouth. There's a tone. I did the tone right before. Did you... you pay attention to the tone, right? I mean, you know, you can have this conversation with a person. Hypothetical conversation with the rat, right? You know, rat's just going, well, yeah, doesn't understand English. Anyways, but if you think about this, if it reduces the attention, it's going to take a while before your cellular starts going, hey, you know, there is a tone. There is a tone occurring. I've learned to ignore the tone, but the tone actually seems to predict this. Oh, huh. Yeah, that might be important. So if you will, the salience of the tone drops down, and then it has to increase as we go here. You might also treat, you might also look at latent inhibition as the production of a CS minus. So presenting the tone a whole bunch of times by itself, a CS minus indicates the lack of occurrence of the US. So maybe what we've really got here is in latent inhibition, by presenting this stimulus a whole bunch of times, we've actually turned it into a CS minus, and then we in our CS-US pairing, we need to essentially learn that it's no longer a CS minus, it's actually a CS plus. It predicts the occurrence of the US. On a theoretical grounds, that works. Empirically speaking, though, you don't tend to be able to, using the CS pre-exposure, presenting the stimulus a whole bunch of times on your own, you don't tend to be able to use that stimulus then to suppress responding to some other excitatory conditional stimulus. So you can't take a light that you've already turned into a CS plus and now pair it with your tone, I've used as an example, and get the conditional response to the light to be reduced. So in that case, even though in theory, you know, it's possible that we've got, by presenting the stimulus a whole bunch of times by itself in pre-exposure, we've produced a CS minus. In practice, empirically, we don't seem to get that. So habituation tends to be the a reduction in the attention or some sort of change in the salience of the stimulus tends to be the most common way of looking at this. Another one we can look at here is U.S. pre-exposure. So in this case here, our subjects are exposed to an unconditional stimulus before the CS U.S. parents. And again, in this case here, if we've got a U.S. pre-exposure group, you know, food, let's use shock. Shock, 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 a bunch of mild shocks. Then when it's like, okay, let's pair our tone with the shock in our pre-exposure group and in our control group, we find that we get a much stronger conditional response in our control group that's never had the U.S. pre-exposure. So here, again, it seems to be the pairings, the pre-exposure to the unconditional stimulus slows down the production of the conditional response. Now, in this case here, the predominant interpretation that's being currently floated around used is what's called the associative interference hypothesis by Hall. And the suggestion here is that what happens during the U.S. pre-exposure is when you're presenting the U.S. a bunch of times. Yeah, there's no obvious conditional stimulus, but the associative interference says there's some context that your subject is in. A room, a chamber, whatever it happens to be. And it says these contextual stimuli become conditional stimuli. So if you're only getting the shock in this operant chamber, you know, so we put you in this operant chamber and we give you a bunch of foot shocks, you go, yeah, you know what? I don't get foot shocked anywhere else. I just need to get foot shocked right here. Then the chamber itself becomes a contextual CS. So then when we try to present, say, the tone with the shock, your subject's already going, no, I know what predicts the shock. The shock is this chamber. I'm in this chamber. I'm going to get shocked. Yeah, but the tone also is telling you about the shock. I don't need to hear the tone. I know. If I'm in this chamber, I'm going to get shocked. We'll talk about blocking in just a little bit, but if you will, this is kind of like blocking, right? So you train on one CS, and then you bring in another CS, and what you've learned about the first CS interferes with blocks the learning of your second conditional stimulus there. So the suggestion then is what's happening according to associative interference interpretation is that to in our U.S. pre-exposure group, they've got to extinguish the context CSs to then be able to associate these novel, your novel CS, the, in this example, the tone, with the U.S., the shock. Okay, so that's one possibility. Could this be habituation as well? Any chance that we've just like habituated the U.S.? You know, use a mild shock. It's like, you know, it's like do that after a while. It's like, yeah, you don't really notice it very much. How can we test that? What do we think? Any ideas? How can we distinguish or try to test between habituation interpretation or the context contextual stimuli learning? Yeah. Okay, so we could perhaps play with the context. So, I mean, the black room itself might become a context, but maybe we just shock them all over the place. You know, take your rat for a walk. It's like, oh, what just happened here? You know, put it in an operant chamber. Bzz, you know, put it in a white chamber. You know, in a white room with black curtains by the station, that sort of thing. Whatever, and shock it in different locations. So, yeah, maybe we can, you know, make a random association. There's no obvious contextual stimuli there. Yeah, that could be one thing we could do. What should happen with habituation? Okay, it won't matter necessarily where. How about time course? What's the time course on habituation compared to classical conditioning? Yeah, it's much faster. It wears off. It's ephemeral. So maybe what we could do is if this is really, you know, if it's really a learning something about the context stimuli, then if you do some training, then wait for a few days before coming back and testing. It shouldn't make a difference. If it's habituation, you wait for, you know, even a few hours, and the habituation processes should have worn off. Yeah, so we've got a few ideas of how we could test that. That's, yep. So if you're shocking the rat at random times and random places and whatnot, is it going to be able to habituate to that? Well, remember, habituation is dealing, I mean, the way we talked about habituation before was that it's just a reduction in reflexive action. So if we give a little shock to your finger or your foot or whatnot, that completes the reflex arc. If we present that stimulus time after time after time, as long as it's the same stimulus, from that point, you know, your eyes will be closed, whatever, it shouldn't really matter according to basic sort of habituation theory there. All you're doing there is you're habituating that reflex arc down at the synaptic, the axon terminal. You're changing the amount of neurotransmitter that's being released there. So in that sense, if we've one way to test this could be, in that case, just is it permanent or not? Habituation shouldn't be permanent. If we're trying to eliminate the context stimuli and we still get, so if we've done the best job we can to randomize out the context stimuli, make sure there's nothing consistent, even, you know, the people that are administering the shock are different, there's perhaps no people present at all, whatever it happens to be. Suppose we can, if we're still getting this, then it's like, context stimuli doesn't seem to be working. Even if it's somewhat random in terms of location, that shouldn't affect habituation. If we have too much time passing between the deliveries of the shock, that could make the habituation harder, right? Because, again, it is a fairly short-term sort of thing. So we can't, you know, we need to keep these presentations of the stimuli fairly close together there. But controlling for that, we could test this out. So, sounds like a possible independent study for somebody to do. Just, you know, get some rats. Get some rats and stuff. Yeah. A study by Ares Moore and Vigorito in 1984 looked at stimulus salience, stimulus novelty, and they used a conditioned suppression methodology or testing process here. So they're working with rats. Okay, so we're going to take a look at salience and novelty of stimuli. So here's their stimuli. They got either a tone, so two CSs, tone, light, and their unconditional stimulus, shock. Stage one, they pair the CS with a US, use a suppression ratio to see what effect they've got, right? So then if you present the CS, if this is causing a freezing condition response, your suppression ratio should go down. It's more suppression. Stage two, pair the second CS with the US. Now, it's either going to be a novel or familiar CS. In other words, we're going to pair either the CS that we got before with the US some more, or we're going to pair a different CS with the US. Check this out. On the check our second CS out with suppression ratio measure. And then stage three, they're just going to extinguish. check this with extinguishing the second unconditional stimulus. So, I goofed. This was not supposed to be here now. Pretend you don't see it. It's not there. Just don't look. Okay. Our blue line means that in the first phase they get a tone, in the second phase they get a tone. Our yellow line, here's where we've got First phase, tone. Second phase, light. So our blue, tone, familiar. Yellow, tone, light, novel. Okay? And then our green here, light tone, and light. Now, just taking a look at this, you notice there's some interesting things here. The first stimulus here, paired with shock, and checking out the suppression ratio, easier to condition lights. Okay, the subjects just biologically seem to be more easily conditionable to lights and foot shock. Think back to Garcia and Kohling. Okay, you know, for a rat, a visual stimulus may be very important in terms of perhaps, you know, indicating pain in the feet. It steps on something or whatnot that's sharp. I don't know, something like that. I mean, you're not going to hear a broken piece of glass that you're about to step on. So foot shock, maybe a visual stimulus just in the rat's, you know, neural architecture is more easily conditionable. Okay. But in either case, we do get these patterns. Now, in the second stage, now we've presented our second conditional stimulus paired up with the US. So now stage two, second stimulus, is paired up with shock. And so we get our, the blue is second stimulus is tone, green, second stimulus is tone. The difference here is the blue, our blue line here is our familiar group. Green is the novel, and in our red and yellow here, again, we've got light as the second stimuli here. Now, now take a look at the red. So our familiar stimuli, the tone, and the light, show less suppression across the blocks of trials here, across the 3 days. So what's important here is not the relative position on the suppression ratio, but the amount of change from day one to day three. Okay, so in terms of our blue and our red, the familiar case here, we get, relatively speaking, much less suppression here with training than we do for our novel. So in this case here, it's like, oh, look, you know, it's a new stimulus. I got to learn something new here. There we go. In the case of the familiar, you've already learned something about these. It's interfering with your subsequent learning. So this is our pre-exposure. Okay. And then they extinguish them. Right. So some data. Now, in terms of salience and intensity, very commonly we back up. When we define salience, we call it the significance of a stimuli, the noticeability of the stimuli, how detectable the stimuli is. Very commonly, we just talk about salience and intensity as meaning the same thing. Even in, you know, Psychology 281 here with students, I'll just talk about these interchangeably, salience and intensity. So, more intense the stimulus, the more salient it is. The more salient it is, the more intense it is. Welcome to 381. It's actually a little bit more complicated than this. At low to moderate levels, yeah, we can probably treat salience and intensity as synonymous terms. Okay? So low to moderate level of a light, the brighter the light is, the more salient it is, and, you know, you might also say if we had some, you know, a photometer out here, you'd say, yeah, the brighter the light is, the more intense it is, according to my photometer. Let's get into a high level, a high intensity stimulus here. Let's even consider something that's perhaps producing physiological damage, or at least pain. So, you know, I've got a really bright Krieg light that I'm flooding you. This is like the kind of thing that you can spotlight planes of 30,000 feet from the ground, you know, big searchlights, you know, shine lights onto the moon kind of thing. If I'm shining that, it's like, wow, really intense light, should be very salient. Actually, you probably can't see at this point, right? Your retina's just gone, okay, activation of my rods and cones, and I'm blind. Until I get neurotransmitter back, this may be permanent. Okay, it's like, why you shouldn't stare at the sun? Okay? Hey, sun pretty salient. Yeah, look at it too long. It's too intense. Burning. Smell that? Yeah, it's your retina burning. Okay, you can't actually smell your retina burning, all right? You have to have a nose in the inside of your eye, okay? It doesn't work like that. But still, right, you can be doing permanent damage to your retina like that, okay? So at that point, you'd say, well, it's definitely an intense stimulus. Is it salient? Probably not, because it's like you're in so much pain. My eyes are melting, okay? It's like, I'm not detecting anything. So it's better to treat intensity as a component of salience, right? So up to some point, you know, intensity and salience parallel are fairly synonymous, but then they kind of take a little bit of a divergence. So just keep that in mind. There are some studies out there, you know, if you keep going on in the field and reading more stuff in the area, you might find cases where it's like, well, we tried to use a more intense stimulus, and in fact, the learning wasn't that great, but it seems to be, I mean, generally, the more salient something is, the more you should learn about it. It's like, yeah, but you got to be careful what you mean about salience, right? Maybe too stimulating. Ever heard of the Yerkes-Dodson curve? The inverted U? Cognitive psychologists like this stuff. Okay? It says that there is some optimal amount of stimulation for learning. So there's an optimal range. It's literally an upside-down sort of U curve. At low salience, they just talk about a salience, okay, but here's where we're going to talk about intensity. So at a low salience, there's very little learning because it's just not detectable. The stimulus just isn't detectable enough. You don't attend to, you don't notice it. Then you get into some optimal range, and learning works pretty well, you know, good, strong, quick learning. But then the stimulus becomes too salient or too intense, will be the better way of saying this, and it's too stimulating, it's too distracting, you can't attend to it, it's too loud, it's too bright, it's too frenetic, whatever happens, and you don't learn as much in that case. Okay, so you also see this in the Yerkes-Dodson effect. There are some things we can do with salience here as well. So, I mean, we can increase the salience via intensity up to a point, but we can also play around with it in terms of relevance. So we can look at this in terms of, say, physiological needs. So if you are very, very hungry, then something, a stimulus that indicates food, you know, if you're very food deprived, a stimulus that indicates food may become much more salient than a stimulus that indicates something aversive, right? So, you know, if you are really hungry, like starving, and it's like, oh, look, there's some food sitting, there's a loaf of bread, or here's a sandwich sitting on this rock, and you completely fail to notice, you know, the lion waiting just behind the rock, right? It's put out bait, right? If lions ever get smart enough, right? You know, it's like I'll put out this sandwich. That's right. Come a little closer. Come a little closer. Sandwich, says the human. Sandwich, goes the lion. You know, gets the human. Get how that works? Sandwich, Sam. Just, yeah. A few people laughed, but not enough. I'm obviously going to have to work on that joke before I go off to Vegas. Okay, so, but anyways, geez, that got more of a laugh. Wow, what's that telling me? All right, but a physiological need. You may not notice something that is dangerous if there is something very, you know, okay, that's silly. Lions obviously aren't putting out, you know, sandwiches to lure people. But, you know, it's like, so hungry, banana! But you don't see the song Deo. Deo, Deo, you know, the deadly black tarantula hiding in the bunch of bananas. It's like, oh, must eat banana, so hungry. But you miss the deadly black tarantula, which bites you and you die. Never going to be hungry again. Yes. Anyways, so in this case, physiological needs may make one thing more or less salient that way. Similarity of environmental stimuli to naturalistic things. So here's an example. This terry cloth covered wood structure of actually cardboard tube wrapped in something slightly fuzzy and, oh, I don't know, small pillow or Nerf football wrapped in something fuzzy. Put these together, it really doesn't look like much of anything. Now, to a quail, it looks, to a male quail, you know, a randy, horny male quail, it looks vaguely like a female quail. So may direct some courtship behavior towards this. But you slap a head on it, and suddenly it looks a lot like a female quail. Okay? This gets a lot of courtship behavior then. But wait a minute. It's sure, that looks pretty much like a female's quail head, but I mean, it's like a cardboard tube and a Nerf football wrapped in flannel or something. It's like, yeah, but it's sort of what a female quail would look like, or at least more so than this. Okay, so this becomes a much more salient stimulus. It's much more naturalistic in that sense. We might also call this the idea of belongingness and come back to our equipotentiality premise from Garcia and Colin here. Now, as I said before, you know, just a few minutes ago, this goes back to Pavlov. So Pavlov was saying basically that any stimulus, relatively speaking, will be equally conditional to any other stimulus. So if your CS1 is easily associated with the US1, it should also be easily associated by the US2, et cetera, et cetera. So easy stimuli to easy stimuli. But he said, you know, if you got a stimulus that's hard to associate, then it should be hard to associate with anything else as well. And as we said, Garcia and Colling demonstrate this. So this idea here of naturalistic stimuli, what belongs together, well, in this case, you know, a head belongs on this body. Okay, these things, I mean, you know, quails don't typically find headless females sitting around. In the same way, you know, the classic bit with the turkeys and their courtship behavior towards a decapitated female turkey head, the male will do his whole courtship routine to that. Modal action pattern going on here. That's stupid. It's like, yeah, but from a naturalistic perspective, male turkeys never find just female turkey heads lying around someplace or on a little stick at about the right height. If there's a head, there should be a body. Well, in this case here, you know, same deal. If there's a head for the female quail, there's going to be a body. If there's a head and a body, there's the female quail. Direct your courtship behavior there. Those things, you know, belong together. It's kind of like the Sesame Street thing. You know, which of these things go together? Which of these things just doesn't belong? Okay, so this is, you know, Sesame Street and Pavlov. All right, there we go. So I said, you know, you've got to consider this in terms of the naturalistic biology of the organisms. So Garcia and Colling's work, which we already talked about, you know, an hour ago or so there, looks at this and says, you know, you can't just assume that just because one stimulus is easy to associate with the U.S., it's going to be equally easy with all. Part of this, part of the reason I think that the equipotentiality became so strongly entrenched up to the 1960s was that, you know, for most of the psychologists, they're very divorced from the naturalistic world in this sense. They bring their subjects into these very controlled laboratory spaces, which means they can do very good empirical cause and effect analyses, but sometimes, I mean, it means they're using things like tones and lights and some food and some shock, you know, stuff like that, vibration stimuli, these kinds of things. You know, they're not using the full range of kinds of, I mean, when was the last time you saw a rat pressing a lever to get food, you know? Look down, you know, you're not going to find them in Edmonton because we're a rat-free, you know, quote-unquote rat-free province, but, you know, go to Vancouver with rats, you know? Walk around, you know, downtown off of Granville there, walk around Vancouver, something, look down the alley there, you know, could catch some rats, see some rats there, you know. You're never going to see a rat just standing up against the wall, you know, wall in an alley pressing a lever. And it's like, yeah, what you doing? Keep on moving. I'm just getting food here. Go away. All right, you know. They're in dumpsters and, you know, crawling around. I think they're training the street people to help them get into the dumpsters. Or maybe the street people, you know, in you go, my army of rats, bring me out the things that are in the garbage. Yes. Interesting place, Vancouver. So, stimulus relevance then. Okay, in terms of the biological predispositions, right? You got to think about this. What's evolved? What makes sense for the particular species? Pigeons. Let's consider pigeons here. So visual conditional stimuli, more easily associated than audio conditional stimuli with food. How does a pigeon hunt? Well, you know, hunt. It's like, yes, here's a pigeon. You know, it's like the old nature shows. Yes, the predator slowly stalks. It's like, yes, the wild pigeon is hunting for its favorite food, grain. Ooh. Right? But it's flying around, right? It's not like listening for grain to fall on the ground or like somebody throwing crumbs to the birds. It's like, you know, you got someone sitting out in quad throwing part of their muffin for the bird. It's like, oh, I hear a muffin crumb drop. No, it's like, oh, I see muffin. Okay, so visual stimuli, yeah, that makes sense. Pigeons' food don't make a lot of sound. I worked with water striders for my PhD. They got big eyes. They can see things. But the way they tend to find their food is, another little bug falls on the water surface, starts kicking and thrashing, creates ripples, vibrations. The water striders, their legs, they have sensors in them that pick up the vibratory stimuli, and they use these to actually orient and catch the prey, bring them over to the prey, and then they grab them. They only use the visual feedback for just like right when they get to the prey and, you know, grab it with their front legs. You can put something that's, you know, a very juicy fly on the surface of the water, but if it's not vibrating because it's thrashing, if it's already dead, well, the water striders kind of, you know, swim on by. It's like, fly, right here, food. I mean, you can see it, right? It's like, well, probably this blob on the water surface shows up in their visual, you know, component of their visual nervous system. But they don't attend to it as food because it's not fiber. They'll eventually, if they actually stumble right onto it, it's like, bump, oh, yeah, that's food. I can eat that. And they will. But again, best thing there, vibratory, you know. You take a vibrating probe, and blah, 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 put some little ripples on the surface, and go over and try to eat the little vibrating probe. It's like, dude, it's not food. Doesn't it look different? They can't tell. Okay. So, you know, think about this. In the case of pigeons, an auditory CS is easier to condition than a visual CS if the US is shot. Okay, so biologically different. Fear conditioning in primates, both rhesus monkeys and human children. Easy to set up a picture of a snake as a CS. I mean, show kids snakes. Ah, scary, you know, or spiders, scary, versus flower. It's like, oh, the rose. It's okay. Right? Like, this is a highly poisonous, toxic flower, right? It's like, ah, pretty. No, I'm trying to tell you. Don't touch it. So pretty, bright. Okay. Will Coxon and colleagues, 1971, looked at biological preparedness and conditioning. So, rats. Rats are, generally speaking, more nocturnal. They tend to get around more at night. Quails, much more diurnal. At night, they're going to sleep. Did taste aversion. Okay, so they either had blue water that they just food coloring dyed blue, or water that they flavored so it had a sour taste to it. Thinking about the way that, you know, rats being nocturnal, quails being diurnal. Quails, much easier to condition the blue water as the aversive CS, okay? Visual stimulus. So you look at it, it's visual. It's like, whoa, stay away from that. In the case of the rats, taste. The sour, much more easily conditioned to the sour. If it's dark anyways, if you're nocturnal and it's dark, right? It's like, is this water blue or just water colored? Oh, it tastes sour. Next time they're exposed, you know, after being made ill, sour. Much more easily conditionable there. So again, the biology, the biological preparedness comes in very strongly here. Okay. Just want to mention higher. We're going to talk a little bit about higher conditioning, higher order conditioning here. So, you know, this should really be very much a review from 281. You got your first order, so CS paired with US. Eventually, you keep doing this, you get your CR. Second order. In this case here, we cut the US out. CS, we take a new CS, or a new novel stimulus. Let's call it the CS2. Okay, so CS2 paired with the US. Our CS2 now produces a CR. We can keep going. Third order, a new CS paired with our CS2. Okay, we do that. So CS3 paired with CS2. Eventually, CS3 produces a CR as well. One of the interesting things here in higher order conditioning, second order, third order, is, you know, if you do a few pairings, enough pairings here, but, you know, you don't do an excessive amount, yeah, you tend to get the higher order conditioning. So if we've done our, if we do this just as phase one, phase two, phase three, okay, if we do it in this very simple way, phase one, CS, I don't care, 100 pairings between your CS1 and your US. We got a really good, strong conditional response, okay? If you do, you know, 10, 15 pairings of CS2 with CS1, you get a conditional response. If you did maybe 100 pairings of CS2 with CS1, you might instead get the production CS2, may become a CS-. Now, the reason for this is because what we're doing here is CS2 starts out, we start associating with CS1. CS1 means the US, but it keeps going. CS2, well, we never get the US. In essence, what we're doing is we're extinguishing the CS1 as we go here. Okay? So if all you did was these as phases, you know, first order phase one, second order phase two. If you just do it like that, a few pairings, yeah, we get higher order conditioning here. A lot of pairings, we maybe may get a CS minus, or we just may get nothing at all. No conditional response at all. The solution here, the way to get around that, is don't do it in this just simple phase by phase. Don't just go, yeah, we'll do a whole bunch of phase one. I mean, do that, sure. Start with your phase one, but don't just go into your second order as phase two. Periodically go back and make sure that you're not extinguishing your CS1, right? Every time we just present the CS1 over here in second order without the US, we're doing a little bit of extinction on CS1. So periodically go back and make sure you do a few more of your basic CS-US pairings, right? Prevent the extinction. If you do that, then you can do as many, you know, CS2, CS1 pairings as you want, and you'll still get your CS2 producing a CR. Okay, but you got to make sure that you don't extinguish your CS1 here. Right? Okay, make sense? Yeah. Okay. Now, there's a lot of really interesting things with respect to second order or higher order conditioning, and oddly, despite some real interest in this back in the late 60s and early 70s, people just sort of stopped researching it. In a lot of respects, for whatever reason. It just, I don't know, it became untrendy, or I honestly don't know why, but once the basic sort of elements seem to have been learned about this, people just kind of, they played around with it a bit, but you don't see that much attention being really directed towards higher order conditioning now. So I just want to talk a little bit about a few sort of the interesting things coming out of some early work in higher order conditioning, and might give you a few things to kind of think about there as perhaps avenues for future resource or future research. So Risley and Roscorla, 70. This is the same Roscorla of Roscorla Wagner fame there from 72. They were asking what if we set up a CS2 through higher order conditioning, and then we go and extinguish the CS1. Completely extinguished. So we'll pair the CS1 with your CS2. Then we're going to pair your CS2 with your CS1. Okay, so we'll do a few trials here. We'll establish the CS2 as a so the CS2 produces a CR. And then we're going to stop pairing your CS2 with your CS1. Okay, so we've done that. Now what we're going to do is just present the CS1 by itself. We're just going to do straight up extinction. So, unlike this, so we do CS1 US, CS2 CS1, then we stop pairing the CS2 with our CS1, and we do a few pairings of this 20, 30 pairings. We get a conditional response. Then we just present the CS1 by itself until the CS1 is extinguished. What's going to happen to the CS2? So after we've done our higher order conditioning, if we then subsequently, intentionally, extinguish the CS1, does this have any effect on the CS2? As it turns out, it really doesn't seem to. So here's what they did. They used a tone as a CS1, shock as your US, and light as the CS2, that experimental group. So in their experimental group, phase 1, CS1 US pairing. Phase 2, CS2, CS1. Phase 3, extinction of the CS1, so it's presented by itself. And then phase 4, they test the CS1 and they test the CS2, and they see how much conditional response they've got. Control group, phase 1, same as in the experimental, CS1 paired with the US. Phase 2, CS2 associated with the CS1. And phase 3, here's the difference, nothing. Okay, there's no extinction in the control group, no extinction of CS1. Then phase 4, test the CS1, test the CS2. Here's what they get. So again, they're using suppression using rats and suppression ratios. Okay, so in both our CS1 and CS2, in our phase, they're doing phase 2 here, tossing some probe trials into their phase 2. So we're doing an acquisition of the CS2. They've been pairing the CS2 with the CS1. And over over days here, they're do a probe trials at the end, and we find that sure enough, by continually pairing your doing 8 days of trials of pairing your CS1 with your CS2, we get some pretty strong suppression. Okay, right now the CS2 is producing a fear response, and the rats freeze. If they've frozen, they're not pressing the lever, so lever pressing is suppressed. Experimental and control groups here. Okay, that's what we got. So we test the light. That's our CS2. Okay, so we just do some testing here, some probe trials, and yeah, still pretty strong suppression over here. We test the CS1. Now remember, the blue is from our experimental group. Okay, they're the ones that have had their phase 3 involving extinction of CS1. Take a look. I mean, no suppression here. Our control group didn't have that phase 3, didn't have the extinction of the CS1 initially here, and they were on this for like 12 days of testing here. Initially, a lot of suppression. As time goes, remember, our probe trials are extinction trials, in essence. As time goes, this wears off. We get some extinction here. But without having that phase 3, that extinction process, your tone has still got the suppression effect, still produces the CR. So this is what's significant over there. So in this case, CS2, regardless of whether or not the CS1 was extinguished or not, we still got strong suppression here for both of our groups, even though our CS1 shows no suppression in our experimental groups. So extinguishing the CS1 after you have established the CS2 has no effect on the CS2. So you can extinguish the CS1, won't matter. Keep that in mind. We'll come back to why that might be interesting for some reasons, or in some applied situations. Holland and Rescorla, 75. Here's Rescorla again. Rescorla did a lot of this stuff. CS1's light, CS2 is tone, US is food. Okay, so they pair CS1 with the US, then CS2 with the CS1. Okay. Then what they do is they satiate the US. They, in other words, stuff food. they let the rats eat as much as they can. What this is doing is devaluing the unconditional stimulus. So initially, right, during our initial training here, you know, they're going to have the rats a little bit food deprived. They're motivated to respond to get the food, okay? And then what they do is they satiate the US. Now, there's actually two ways they did this. In the one case, that's the data I'll show you, they just give the rats access to as much food as they can possibly eat. They are in no way hungry at this point. It's like, how about some more food? Oh, gods, no. No, come on, just a little bit. I'd explode. Okay, so it's like, no, that's going to make me sick. Say the rats, in rat speak. The other thing they do to devalue the U.S. is in a second group, and I'm not going to show you the data from that one, but they give the rats some food. It's like, here you go. Here's some food. Then they put them in a bucket, and they spin them around quickly. Okay? So it's like, now that you've eaten that big meal, now we're going to make you really motion sick. It's like, oh, food. But they can't throw up. Right? So, I mean, you know, if it was a person, you're spinning them around, it's like, you know, go to the X this year, you know, eat 12 corn dogs, and then get on something that's going to spin you around really quickly. You know, you'll probably be vomiting at some point. Well, the rats can't, so they just feel really nauseous. So in other words, food is now really devalued for them. Either way, okay. So then they test. They test the condition stimuli once, condition response weakened. Condition stimulus 2's CR, though, unaffected. Now look, CS1 paired with US, CS2 paired with CS1. Devalue the US. The only thing it affects is the conditional response to the CS1. Doesn't extrapolate over to our CS2. Okay, so manipulating our CS1 US relationship doesn't affect the relationship, or doesn't affect the representation, the rat's nervous system representation of what the CS2 means. CS2 still means make this CR, even though we've devalued the US. You know, there's some interesting stuff here in terms of, we'll come back to in terms of stimulus substitution. Okay. Now, a couple things to think about with this. Well, I'll give you one thing right now to think about with this. So, celebrities. We use advertising uses celebrities a lot. So you take a well-known celebrity, you pair them up with a product. The product becomes your celebrity will treat as your CS1. Your celebrity has been associated with fame, success, attractiveness, blah, 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 heroic roles, whatever they happen to be, all sort of positive things. There's your US. You pair the celebrity up with a product. Product is your CS2. Now consider, when celebrities then go and do something, you know, problematic, like, oh, gosh, you know, Tiger Woods or... Michael Jackson used to be a very prominent advertiser for Pepsi. Then he just started, you know, the first of the various child molestation cases came up. Boom, not advertising for Pepsi anymore. Britney Spears, you know, was advertising for Pepsi. Then she just got crazy and no longer advertising for Pepsi. Right. Kobe Bryant had big sports endorsement contracts. Charged with rape, gone, commercials get pulled. What's happening here is advertisers go, it's like, oh, look, if our brand is paired with a celebrity and the celebrity is popular, our brand should be popular. But then suddenly the celebrity goes and does something that makes the celebrity unpopular. We have to pull the, we pull the commercials there. Is it as big of a risk as it should be? Well, the change in the CS1, according to Mascorla's work here, 1775, the change in your CS1 isn't going to directly affect CS2. So, you know, here's the interesting thing. No one goes, oh, you know, here's what I find very interesting, because in a way, Nike is bucking things right now. So it's like Pepsi. Pepsi had Britney Spears advertising. Then Britney went all crazy, cut her hair, doing weird things with her kids, yada, 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 yada. But nobody goes back and says, wow, Pepsi, yeah, they're like jerks because like they employed Britney Spears to advertise for them. And nobody does that because as long as they stop advertising, as long as they stop using her, right? So Britney Spears goes from being wonderful to being insane, the kind of person, you know, she said, really, drink Pepsi. It's like, yeah, thank you, crazy person. I don't think I will, because who knows what's going to happen with that, right? So as long as they're no longer associating, as long as they don't keep associating themselves with Britney Spears, they're fine, okay? and nobody retroactively, you know, blames a company for using a celebrity endorser. It's not like, oh yeah, that Pepsi, they're terrible because they've used, you know, Michael Jackson before he did something inappropriate, Britney Spears before she did something inappropriate, Madonna did something inappropriate, they dropped her, they picked her up again, they dropped her again, they picked her up again. Madonna just comes and goes, okay, with stuff. But it doesn't transfer as long as they stop right there. If the CS1, if our celebrities' attitude gets changed, but they continue to pair the celebrity with their product, so let's say Pepsi just kept using Britney Spears, you know, even though Britney Spears' sort of CR produced by her, initial most response produced by her, has shifted, then Pepsi's going to get in trouble. So as long as they stop, there's no ill effects. But they have to cancel, they have to stop using the celebrity whose CS1 has changed. If they do that, then there's no consequences to them, right? It doesn't, you know, then a change to the CS1 has no effect on the CS2, the brand. Here's where things have been interesting with Tiger Woods. Nike, despite the whole mistresses and prostitutes and sex addiction stuff with Tiger Woods, has kept using Woods as a spokesperson. So Woods is the CS1 here, or he's the CS1. The conditional response, perhaps produced by him, has changed due to all of this. But Nike's saying, no, we're just going to keep you as the endorser. Isn't that going to be changing, you know, the attitudes towards the brand? Yeah. Right. And I think this is the interesting issue in this case. And I think this is the difference with Kobe Bryant, who was accused of rape. It's like Woods, it's like he's an adulteress and he's got mistresses and possibly prostitutes. He's a jerk, but it's not like he did anything horribly illegal in that sense. It's not like he was raping prostitutes. I'm not trying to, like, come off with a, hey, Woods was great for this, but you're right. Culturally, it's like, oh, he's a superstar, he's attractive, he's athletic, he's dominant. Yeah, I mean, societally, maybe we cut. And also, let's face it, who's mainly buying Nike golf products? Men. Yeah, to some extent, I think they do. So, you know, we get some very interesting things with this here. Whereas, you know, Britney Spears, Pepsi, well, crazy is crazy. You know, weird attitudes there. Yes, drink Pepsi, shave all your hair, abandon your kids. No. So interesting stuff on this. Okay. Sensory preconditioning. Take two stimuli, say light and a tone, pair them together. Okay. Take one of them, I don't care which, pair it with a US, do first order acquisition. Turn it into a CS. Second stimulus is also going to produce a conditional response now. Again, you know, we've got these other connections. So in this case, a little bit different from our higher order conditioning here. Okay? So in higher order conditioning, CS1 with a US, CS2 a CS1, CS2 now produces CR. In this case here, just two stimuli. They're not conditional stimuli at this point. Just get paired together, turn one of them into the CS, transfer. You're making an association. Okay? We make that connection between them. Just these two things go together. Do they mean anything? Not yet, they don't. They just go together. But then if you turn one of them into a conditional stimulus, that prior association, that sensory preconditioning, kicks in. And you go, wait a minute. Light and tone go together. Tone now produces a conditional response. Light goes with tone. Light should produce that conditional response. So we can change the sequencing of this as well. In blocking, we get something a little bit different. Again, we've got a sequencing of stimuli here. So pair your CS1 and your US repeatedly, produce a strong conditional response from your CS1. Now produce a compound CS, present CS1 and CS2 together. Keep pairing with the US. You'll find that your CS1 is going to produce a strong conditional response, CS2, weak conditional response. We say that the CS1 blocks the learning about the CS2. Contrast this with if we just start with a compound conditioned stimulus. Let's assume that we have, say, a tone and a light, and let's assume that we've equalized their saliences, so we're not going to have an overshadowing effect. Okay, so if we just start with tone and light together paired up with the US, it's fine. We're not going to have any blocking. If we then separately test, you know, do I don't care how many trials, 692 trials, because that's your favorite number, then we test out our conditional response for our both our tone and our light. They will both produce a conditional response. So the issue here is when you produce, when you bring in the compound conditional stimulus. In this case here, if you bring it in after you've already conditioned one of the stimuli, you will get the blocking effect. Okay. Let's take 10 minutes, and then we will continue with this.